listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, just some quick updates. I'm going to be doing some traveling here in the next couple of weeks. And just so you know, we're on May 1st, on Thursday, May 1st, I will be in Seattle at the Seattle Town Hall at an event sponsored by Elliott Bay Books and Town Hall Civics Series. It's $5 at the door, and that all goes to pay for the venue. I'm showing up on my own nickel. And you can get more details on that. All of these, TomHartman.com, we should, if we don't have links to them now, we will sort shortly. TownHallSeattle.org. That's Thursday, May 1st. Friday, May 2nd, I'll be in Portland, Oregon at the First Unitarian Church. Talking about my, in all cases here, talking about my book, The Crash of 2016. And on Friday, May 10th, I'll be in Northampton, Massachusetts at the Parlor Room. It's free, but you have to sign up with WHMP, our Northampton, Mass. Local radio station affiliate, and their website is, who is sponsoring this gig, and their website is WHMP.com. So get over there if you're going to be in the, you know, if you want to come say hi. We're going to have a little reception first and then a book signing. It'll be a very, you know, friendly, personal, intimate gathering. It'll be a lot of, actually, well, Seattle and Portland might be a little larger, but, you know, in every case, I'll be there and I'll be available to sign books and shake hands and talk with you. And so May 1st, Seattle, May 2nd, Portland, May 10th, Northampton, Massachusetts. And on May 3rd, I'm giving a TEDx talk in Portland, but it's been sold out. So just FYI. So I think it's too late to do anything about that if you want to show up. I was a little concerned about a couple of, there's a bunch of things that I want to go through with you today. I thought, first of all, I thought last night, Rachel Maddow did an exceptionally good job. And I just, you know, every now and then I want to tip my hat to other people in the media, other people who are, who have, you know, I have no relationship with other than just, you know, being in the same business or knowing them, you know, personally or professionally. And, but Rachel just did a spectacular job last night of calling out Fox News. She spent like the first half hour of her show basically pointing out how right-wing extremists in the United States, particularly this one particular virulent and toxic group who believes that county governments are the only legitimate governments in the United States. And part of this belief comes from some very bad misquoting of Thomas Jefferson back before the Constitution was ratified. That the federal government has no authority, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That these groups, I mean, these groups are, Tim McVeigh was a member of one of these groups. David Koresh was in with these folks. Randy Weaver, who, you know, sold sawed-off shotguns to people in these kind of groups, sold one to an ATF agent, and they showed up to raid his home, and he killed a federal agent. They shot his wife and son. They killed one of them. I think it was his wife, taking him into custody. But the point is that that's Ruby Ridge, that Sean Hannity, you know, lovingly refers to. These people hate our federal government. It would not be inaccurate to say they hate America, or at least the way it is formed right now. And that hatred has translated into the death of hundreds of people over the last couple of decades. And Fox News just is breathlessly hyping, or has been. It'll be interesting to see if today they tone it down in response to what Rachel said on MSNBC last night. This is basically the message that I've been saying for 3 days here, and you know we had Sheriff Mack on, and we've had several conservatives on talking about this and trying to figure out what's going on and find some maybe points of commonality or something. But how do you find a point of commonality with somebody who doesn't believe in the sovereignty of the United States of America. I mean, it's like Lincoln trying to find commonality with Lee. You can't do it. So we'll see where this goes. Meanwhile, a couple of stories over at EcoWatch this morning just knocked my socks off. We've got these toxic chemical spills in West Virginia, and you've still got people who are afraid to drink the water and presumably legitimately so. And then we discovered that Pat McCrory, the governor of North Carolina, who for 25, 30 years worked for, was it Duke Energy? Yeah. The big energy company there in the state. And then he comes into office, and now all of a sudden the Environmental Protection Agency, the state Environmental Protection Agency, is here to serve. Let us kiss the butts of the energy company instead. And this energy company is just dumping toxic coal ash, which has heavy metals and poisons and radiation, into the waters, into the rivers. But this is just like, this is just the tip of the iceberg. The Environmental Defense Fund just published a new report. It's called Toxics Across America. And they add up just the chemicals that are in our environment, manufactured, by American chemical companies or imported into the United States, and in our environment, to the tune of more than a billion pounds as of the last time that the government tallied this stuff up, which was 2011, 3 years ago. Ethylene dichloride, 28 billion pounds. Benzene, 23 billion pounds. Benzene causes cancer. Vinyl chloride, 16, 17 billion pounds. Toluene, this causes cancer, 15 billion pounds. Styrenes, 10 billion pounds. Ethylbenzene, 9 billion pounds. Lead, 5 billion pounds. And, formaldehyde, I mean, this is the stuff they use to embalm bodies. It causes cancer. We're all being embalmed. 4 billion pounds. They use it to make plywood. And then over the course of the lifetime of your house, it leaks out of the plywood. It vaporizes. And, we're all becoming embalmed? Under current law, it's really hard to find where these things are being used. They get to hide, the knowledge of this stuff. They looked at 120 chemicals that have been identified by multiple federal, state, and international officials as known or suspected health hazards. 81 of them are produced into more than a million pounds a year. Of these 90 chemicals, at least eight of them are used in children's products. And here's the headline of one of the articles. You are a guinea pig in the greatest uncontrolled experiment ever launched. Lead, vinyl, formaldehyde, asbestos, bisphenol A, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs. It's all better living through chemistry. Now, in Europe, they have the precautionary principle. It even has its own website. It's part of the EU law. You've got, before you can put a poison or chemical, potential poison, a chemical, into the environment in a way that it's going to end up in our bodies, you have to prove that it's safe. Here in the United States, we don't do that. We're having an explosion of obesity. We're having an explosion of autism. We're having an explosion of cancers, particularly childhood cancers. And we're sitting around going, gee, I wonder what's causing it. Well, in 30, 40 years, we'll be able to do the epidemiology and see which one of these chemicals spiked where and correlates with what.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And this is just one more example of how our government serves big corporations and big money thanks to the Supreme Court rather than you and me. Welcome back, Nate Sweet with us. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Nate Sweet, international TV media superstar and producer with The Big Picture. We're going to start out with David Laska is going to be debating me from New York, the Republican policy party guy.
He's communication director for the New York State Republican Party. He'll be on. We'll be talking about whether or not it's time to outlaw billionaires here in the United States. The Koch brothers just reached a new milestone on Wednesday. They now have a total net worth of $100 billion. Obviously, that increases their ability to influence our elections, our political system, but it also increases the amount of money they can hoard and keep to themselves and not put back into the productive economy. And that's what we'll be talking about with David Lasko, whether or not we should take that money from billionaires and put it back into the productive economy.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. And in our second block, in Block B, we're going to get into Japan's whaling.
Yes, we're going to be talking with Captain Paul Watson from Whale Wars. He'll be in studio talking with us. The ICJ has just ruled against Japan's Southern Ocean Whaling Program.
ICJ is?
The International Court of Justice. And there are certain types of whaling that are allowed right now in the world. Some countries can get exemptions from international bans on whaling based on scientific research. Or cultural norms. Some native peoples in Alaska are allowed to whale because of native traditions. But what's going on in Japan is really essentially
commercial whaling. It's a scam.
Yeah.
It's a scam whaling that the Japanese have been doing for four decades.
Yeah. And it's what's really startling is when you think of, a lot of that whale meat is then thrown into lunch, mixed in with lunch meats in Japan. I don't know if any of your viewers have seen the movie The Cove, but a lot of whale and dolphin meat that's harvested in Japan is put in lunch meats and it's, filled with mercury because whales and dolphins are at the top of the food chain, and it's had some really adverse health effects in the past.
Hmm.
It's pretty startling stuff.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of issues we'll get into with Paul Watson. See some clips from the show. It's a great show. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I have not seen The Cove.
It's pretty cool. They're pretty heroic standing up to those Japanese whalers.
Is Paul Watson in The Cove? In The Cove?
I believe he's interviewed. It's been a while since I've seen the movie.
Uh-huh.
But at least the show, Whale Wars, right. It's a great show to watch. I've always enjoyed watching it.
Yeah, I've not seen that one either. I'm gonna have to check it out. That's on Animal Channel, right, or Animal Planet?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then in Block D, we have Your Take, My Take in Block C. And then in Block D, we're talking with Jeff Biggers from EcoWatch. There's been some protests at the University of Washington, St. Louis, trying to get the university to divest from Peabody Coal. So it gives us a chance to talk to Jeff about the broader divestment movement and the role it plays in the fight against climate change.
Yeah, this is a which side are you on, boy? Yeah. Which side are you on? And then our daily take is basically the rant that I was just starting to go off on, which is that we are all friggin' Superfund sites.
Exactly.
And we are all guinea pigs in the greatest uncontrolled experiment ever launched, at least with regard to the human race. It's amazing. When you go back and you look at the study just of the paint companies, how they had, the little Dutch boy out there pitching lead paint when they knew how toxic the lead was. It's like the asbestos companies that killed my father. They knew back in the 30s that asbestos caused mesothelioma, and they were still denying it in the 50s when he was working in a cloud of it. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I mean,
just amazing.
It's crazy because the attitude essentially is, who cares about all that when there's so much money to be made?
Well, and like with my dad, I mean, that company was long gone that exposed him to that asbestos by the time he got sick.
Yeah, no real accountability.
He got sick 30 years later. There was no accountability. Nate Sweet, thanks a lot, Nate. We'll see you tonight. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. So each of us is a Superfund site. Remember a couple of years ago when Bill Moyers had blood drawn and they found 84 cancer-causing chemicals or some mind-boggling thing in his blood? It's got to be worse now. And, here we are, guinea pigs in this giant uncontrolled experiment. And a lot of us are guinea pigs in an experiment that's frankly already been done. I mean, these SOBs killed my dad, for example. Back in 1950, when my dad and mom got married, I was born in May of 51, so it must have been in 1950 that mom got pregnant with me. And when she got pregnant with me, dad dropped out of college. In fact, I think they got married in 49, actually. But in any case, when she got pregnant with me, dad dropped out of college. He wanted to be a history professor when he grew up and went to work in a steel mill up in Grand Rapids. And he was the guy who was standing there as the sheets of steel came out of a blast furnace, across these asbestos-covered rollers. And he just, would move the steel on as it's coming out, red. and he worked in a cloud of asbestos dust. And everybody said, oh, don't worry about that. Didn't even give him a respirator. And they knew at the time that asbestos caused mesothelioma, which is this god-awful, mind-bogglingly painful, horrible way to die, form of cancer of the outside of the lung, the area between your rib cage and your lung, the outside of the lung, the pleura, I think it's called. And, which is what my dad got and what he died of. And we watched him die, and it was a terrible, terrible thing. Sat with him as he was, you know, coughing up his insides. I mean, he was just. And this was because back in the 1950s, some company decided that they'd rather make some profit right now, so their stockholders and their executives could take home a nice fat paycheck, rather than protect their workers by finding an alternative to asbestos. And it wasn't just one company. I mean, there were companies all over America that did this. One of the tobacco companies, there was, you know, one of the cigarettes, I think it was Kent's. I might be wrong, but one of the cigarettes that actually has asbestos in the filters. I think it was the Micronite filter, as I recall. I might be wrong on that. Don't quote me. But they made asbestos ironing board covers. I mean, there's asbestos. Asbestos was in wall compounds and spackle that surrounded water pipes. So anyhow, that was asbestos. I mean, lead. They had known back in the 20s and 30s, they'd known. We had known for probably a century, but we certainly knew at the, you know, with a level of scientific certainty in the 1920s that lead caused massive neurological damage. That there were guys, men and women and children, who worked in factories where they were working directly with lead and lead dust, making parts out of lead for machines and cars and making batteries out of lead, making all kinds of things out of lead, and just getting covered with lead and taking lead home. And they were dying of seizures, and they were having children who were wild and criminal and had low IQs. And turns out it was lead. In fact, when we took lead out of our gasoline in the 1970s, I think it was, about 15 to 20 years later, we suddenly saw the crime rate start to drop. And it's been dropping steadily ever since. And we still have lead in the paint in about 5 million homes in America. But what we know is that when you expose kids to lead, they're more likely to grow up to be criminals. Now, the exact mechanism is not known, but we do know that it does pretty serious neurological damage and it reduces IQ. But it might do much more than that. I mean, it might hamper the part of the brain that we call the conscience. I don't know. The fact of the matter is, though, that a lot of very wealthy people made a lot of money exposing us all to lead. And how much longer are we going to do this in America? Okay, so that's you know, rant number one I wanted to share with you. The second one was, I saw this headline on Huffington Post last night. And remember Bernie last Friday? He was talking about how, you know, 10 years ago the Koch brothers were worth $50 billion, and then a couple of years ago or last year or whatever they were worth $80 billion. And how, you know, how isn't that, my numbers may be off. I don't remember the exact numbers, but their wealth had just grown so. I mean, for two guys, their wealth had grown well over $10 billion in this relatively short period of time. And isn't that mind-boggling? Isn't it mind-boggling that this is like the last minutes of a game of Monopoly? Well, the headline last night in Huffington Post was The Koch brothers are worth $100 billion now. So, you know, with 1% or 2% of their wealth, forget their income, of their wealth, if you could take 1% or 2% of your IRA and with it buy every political race in America and just flip the politics however you want, can you imagine the power? I think it's time for us to put a 100% tax on all wealth over $1 billion. No more billionaires. Billionaires are bad for our economy, they're bad for our body politic, they're bad for America. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, and we've got a few more news stories here to share with you, and anything you want to talk about today, feel free to give us a shout. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Shano just made an interesting point, something I hadn't thought about. What was the big story last week in the news? Just think about it. Think back to last week, right? Step into your little Wayback Machine. Here we are. Today is what, Thursday? Go back to last week, the story that was going into the weekend. Obamacare is working. There are more signups than even they expected. The prices are going down. The health insurance companies are doing fine. That's not a cataclysm for them. Their stock is actually going up, and yet they're lowering their prices to consumers. And more people, particularly in the Republican states, are happy with Obamacare. And now there's a small revolt brewing in the red states like Texas and Florida, in particular Wisconsin. Apparently Michigan has picked up the Medicaid expansion, but the states that have not, Ohio, I believe, you know, where you've got right-wing crazies who want to run for president, you know, right-wing governors, Rick Perry, Rick Scott, John Kasich, Scott Walker, who are refusing to let their own citizens of their states get their own taxpayer dollars back in the form of Medicaid, who are telling the working poor in their state, working class people in their state, who just don't happen to make a lot of money. Like this guy who, I don't know if you've seen this viral video, there was some crazy congressman doing a town hall, and the viral video went out yesterday. And some guy stands up and says, you want to walk in my shoes? I work at Arby's. I make close to minimum wage. Why don't you just do my job for a day? And the kid saying it, the young man saying it, is African American. And the congressman goes off on this rant, which was one of the most eloquent statements of white privilege and demonstrations of how the essence of white privilege, the number one privilege that whites have, is that they never have to think about how privileged they are. Because this guy goes, you know, his response to this minority kid who's saying, you know, or young man, I mean, I consider the average fast food worker is 29 years old, working at or close to minimum wage. He goes off on him about how, I had a job when I was 12 years old, minimum wage job, and look at me, I'm now a congressman, and blah, 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 you know, you can pull yourself up by your bootstrap, blah, blah, blah. He just goes off on a rant. And I'm like, yeah, if you're a member of the Lucky Sperm Club, you know. And yeah, I realize there's a few exceptions that prove the rule. There are, you know, there are the Clarence Thomases of the world. But the fact of the matter is that if you're born poor and a person of color in this country, regardless of your intellect, the probability of you ending up a member of the United States Congress or the CEO of a major corporation, or even a senior executive, or even being employed, are substantially less than if you're born white and even of mediocre intellect. It just blew my mind. Anyhow, how did I get off on that? I went off on a tangent. I was talking about something else. Oh, yeah, healthcare. And so, back where I started here, Shano says, you know, healthcare was the big story last week. And so they've got to be sitting around at Fox News going, oh, my God, we got a health care. You know, people aren't liking healthcare. This is hurting the Republicans. And The governors are getting hurt, and there's a movement now to expand Medicaid, to expand Obamacare in Florida and Texas and Ohio and Wisconsin. And what do we do? What do we do? Ah, there's a rancher who's being displaced. I mean, they tried yelling Benghazi, and nobody's listening anymore. They tried yelling IRS, Lois Lerner, contempt of court. Nobody's listening. Hey, we got a white guy on a horse out west. Oh, that's always good optics. That's made for television, Sean. One problem, this white guy on a horse out west, he doesn't believe in the United States. He thinks that county officials should be able to disarm federal officers. Oh, we can just kind of ignore that. It's amazing. It's amazing. Okay. Our board is damn near full here. Let's start getting some of these calls in here. Wayne in Granby, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP, where I will be on May 10th. Hey, Wayne.
And we cannot wait.
I'm looking forward to it. What's up?
Well, I guess you probably read this many times. In history, we know that part of the reason for the fall of the Roman Empire was that a lot of the elite way back in the, you know, around the...
2,000 years ago.
We're eating off of lead utensils.
Well, not just that. They had in the high-priced housing, they had running water. And it was lead-lined aqueducts that brought the water to them, and you know, lead pipe. I'm not sure it might have been more open, you know, gutter kind of things, but they had, you know, they had facilities, and yeah, their water was all contaminated with lead.
And even as far as maybe 100 years ago, there's the term lead pencil. It just got a basis of fact. Instead of using graphite, they used lead. And what you did was you touched it with your tongue, and that made the print darker.
Right.
Of course, it filled everybody up with lead.
Right, because the acidity of your saliva, you know, sped up the rate at which the lead dissolved.
Exactly.
Yep.
Well, that was it. I just wanted to, you know, bring up a little history.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you, Wayne. Great to hear from you, and I look forward to seeing you on May 10th. Terry in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Yeah, good to talk to you. I hear you all the time.
Thank you.
That was Kent's cigarette filters.
That's what I thought. I thought it was Kent's because my mom smoked Kent's when I was a kid, and I remember when the story came down that they had asbestos in them. Say what?
In the 1950s.
In the 1950s.
It was manufactured somewhere in Massachusetts because everybody who worked in that factory ended up dying from cancer.
Well, that's, you know, the tool and die shop where my dad worked, all of the guys that I knew by name that I remember, all of them died of mesothelioma just like my dad did. And, I mean, there was 14 guys who worked there, and I know at least five or six of them who did. Terry, thank you for the call. The President of the United States is speaking right now. Let's pick him up and find out what he has to say.
Helping with search and rescue as one of our closest allies. Our commitment to South Korea is unwavering in good times and in bad, and that's something I'll underscore during my visit to Seoul next week. Before I take questions, I'd also like to say a few words about how the Affordable Care Act is now covering more people at less cost than most would have predicted just a few months ago. The first open enrollment period under this law ended a little over 2 weeks ago. And as more data comes in, we now know that the number of Americans who've signed up for private insurance in the marketplaces has grown to 8 million people. 8 million people. 35% of people who enrolled through the federal marketplace are under the age of 35. All told, independent experts now estimate that millions of Americans who were uninsured have gained coverage this year.
Time for a Fox News alert about the Bundy Ranch.
Next year and the year after. We've also seen signs that the Affordable Care Act is bringing economic security to more Americans. Before this law added new transparency and competition to the individual market, folks who bought insurance on their own regularly saw double-digit increases in their premiums. That was the norm. And while we suspect that premiums will keep rising, as they have for decades. We also know that since the law took effect, healthcare spending has risen more slowly than at any time in the past 50 years. In the decade before the Affordable Care Act, employer-based insurance rose almost 8% a year. Last year, it grew at half that rate. Under this law, real Medicare costs per person have nearly stopped growing. The life of the Medicare Trust Fund has been extended by 10 years, and the independent Congressional Budget Office now expects premiums for plans on the marketplace to be 15% lower than originally predicted. So those savings add up to more money that families can spend on businesses.
The guys at Fox News are going to start screaming about Benghazi,
hiring new workers.
Bundy.
The CBO now says that the Affordable Care Act will be cheaper than recently projected. Lower costs from coverage provisions will shrink our deficits by an extra $100 billion. So, the bottom line
is, under the
Affordable Care Act, the share of Americans with insurance is up, the growth of health care costs is down, hundreds of millions of Americans who already have insurance now have new benefits and protections, from free preventive care to freedom from lifetime caps on your care. No American with a pre-existing condition like asthma or cancer can be denied coverage. No woman can be charged more just for being a woman. Those days are over. And this thing is working. I've said before, this law won't solve all the problems in our healthcare system. We know we've got more work to do. But we now know for a fact that repealing the Affordable Care Act would increase the deficit, raise premiums for millions of Americans, and take insurance away from millions more. Which is why, as I've said before, I find it strange that the Republican position on this law is still stuck in the same place that it has always been. They still can't bring themselves to admit that the Affordable Care Act is working.
That's the President of the United States. Actually, the Republicans are stuck in this place of they hate the poor, the working poor. People who are working 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week and who are making $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year, maybe, the Republicans just hate them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, if they're white and they're in the suburbs, they want them to vote for them, but they hate them. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Lois in Scott Depot, West Virginia, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Lois, what's up?
Hello. I'm a little bit nervous because I've never spoken on television before.
Well, thank you for calling us.
You're welcome. And I love you, by the way.
Thank you.
I really appreciate what you have to say. But my comment was, you were talking about what Fox News was making that big hype over, that rancher that was grazing his cows for free, basically a freeloader, and how Fox News was, you know, all excited about it. Well, they were filming these snipers up on a bridge that had their guns trained on federal agents. Did you see that part?
I did. Yeah, I saw the clip of that last night on Rachel Maddow's reporting on MSNBC.
I was horrified.
Yeah.
And then they want to yell and fuss and carry on about the Fast and Furious. Well, weren't those federal agents too? I mean, they sat there and filmed these men that had guns trained on our agents. But then they're going to complain, on the other hand, about this Fast and Furious. It just blows my mind.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm not the most intelligent person in the world, and, you know, I know that a lot of these places think because you don't have a high education that you're stupid. But, you know, regular people understand what's going on in this world.
Yep.
You know, we're not as stupid as they think.
I agree.
So anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you, Lois. It was very nice to hear from
you.
You're welcome. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV. And Lois is so right. I mean, it's like, This was the core message of our show on Tuesday, day before yesterday, is that even to the extent that Americans might find themselves identifying with Bundy, You know, people, Americans who watch Fox News and saying, you know, oh, you know, the government is, you know, this guy's getting thrown off his ranch. I mean, isn't it, you know, it's a, he's the little guy, right? It's because all across this country, 34 years of Reaganomics have ripped the guts out of the middle class. GM used to be the biggest employer in this country, and they paid $50 an hour in today's dollars, you know, back in, you know, when Reagan came into office. And today they're paying $14.50 an hour as a starting wage, and Walmart is the biggest employer in our country now, and they pay $10 an hour, more or less. While the Walton family takes like $8 billion a year in subsidies and tax breaks and welfare. In fact, somebody tried to present them with a bill, the Walton family. It was in our newscast. Great. And so, you know, American working people know that they're screwed. The ones watching Fox don't realize that they've been screwed by Reaganomics, by the Republican Party, by the billionaires who are funding Americans for Prosperity and the Tea Party. They don't realize that those are the people who are screwing them. And so they got, you know, and so, you know, they listen to Fox News or right-wing talk radio and they go, oh, well, it must be some liberal college professor who's responsible for this. Or Democrats. How are Democrats responsible for the working people being screwed when Democrats brought us the 5-day work week? Democrats brought us the 40-hour work week. Democrats brought us workplace protections. Democrats brought us, you know, unionization with decent wages. Democrats brought us high taxes on rich people and low taxes on poor people. Democrats brought us Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, you name it, Democrats did it. And somehow Fox News said, oh, it's all the Democrats' fault. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you and Nick in Morris, Illinois. Hey, Nick, what's up?
How's it going, sir? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, you were talking about asbestos. The term asbestos is actually used to describe the mineral formation, and whereas like andalusite, sillimanite, and crocodilite are asbestos-formed minerals. And I know that I think andalusite and sillimanite are okay, but crocodilite is one of the nasty ones that has really fine fibers.
Yeah, that gets in your lungs. What I know is what happened to my dad. What I know is that the co-host, when I was doing a morning show in Portland, Oregon, my co-host, Heidi Tauber, who is now deceased, her mother and father, she grew up in Libby, Montana, and her dad was the sheriff. And that town was a mining town, and they were mining, what is that stuff that it's got a light in it in the name that you put into potting soil? Vermiculite? Yeah, it was vermiculite. Yeah. And they were mining vermiculite there, and which is high in asbestos content, apparently. Or it coexists with asbestos. And they also mined asbestos there. And pretty much everybody she knew from that town growing up, including her parents, they all died of mesothelioma, just like my dad. We started comparing notes on the air one day, and it was just startling. Anyway.
Sorry, but another thing I wanted to mention is you also have to kind of look at the, you know, the actual research that's being done, because when there was a research project done back in the 90s on talcum powder, you know, baby powder,
right?
And they were feeding it to lab rats, and they were feeding it so much of it that it, you know, reached saturation in their blood and was precipitating out. So I mean, of course that lab rat got cancer from it because you were.
You're talking about the study that went wild on the news where they found that there was asbestos in the talcum powder we were putting on babies.
Yeah, I think so. And then they did it back, I think this was, you know, 20 years ago. I read about it maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, I think my recollection is that what they discovered was, I mean, talc is a naturally occurring mineral. You know, they refine it somewhat, but it's basically old calcium carbonate deposits, isn't it? Something like that. It's you know, old seashells, but it has a certain, it can have, some talc formations have also asbestos in them, and others have are low in asbestos. And so they started, looking at their formulations to make sure that they were using low asbestos talc. Anyhow, Nick, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Gene in Florissant, Missouri. Am I saying that right, Gene?
Yes, sir, you are.
Thank you for listening to us on iTunes. What's up?
Well, thank you for doing what you do. I just got one question and one comment. I think there's 4 Koch brothers, which is kind of scary in itself. And the other comment was, can sedition charges be brought, or can their license be revoked to Fox News for causing sedition?
Yeah. I don't know about the fourth Koch brother. There's three that I know of. There's one who's sort of apolitical, and then, you know, he owns this Western town that he's turned into his own little, sort of like Michael Jackson, you know, with his, you know, turning his ranch into Neverland. You know, the one of the Koch brothers has turned some Wild West town into some incredible thing. I don't know about a fourth one. With regard to pulling Foxes or charging Fox with sedition, I think that would be a real stretch. Particularly, and this is something that's really worth, you know, going into the Wayback Machine. In fact, we should get Jane Aker and Steve Wilson back on this program. It has been, have they been on since you've been here, Shane? And you've been here, what, 2 years? Yeah, so it's been probably 4 or 5 years since I had them on. I don't know if they're still together, but Jane Aker and Steve Wilson, AKRE, as I recall, were a husband and wife investigative reporter team who worked for a Fox affiliate in Florida. And this was back in the late 90s or the early 2000s. And they went out to investigate whether there was any danger to people in the and Gene, thanks a lot for the call. Let me just go off on this riff here. They went out to find out if there was any danger to people from the RGBH, the recombinant bovine growth hormone, this artificial growth hormone that was being shot into cattle in Florida. And there's surprisingly, most people don't realize that, you know, cattle's actually a big business in Florida. And so they went out and looked into it. And they came to the conclusion, these two independent reporters working for a local Fox station, came to the conclusion that there were some serious health concerns here, or at least the possibility of them. And so they wrote up the report, and the management of the station, and somehow word got back to Monsanto that they were doing this. And apparently, you know, the station got heard from somebody. And so the manager of the station said to them, you know, you got to rewrite the story. And so they rewrote the story, and they rewrote the story, and they rewrote the story. They ended up rewriting the story almost 30 times, as I recall. I've had them on, like I said, I've had them on the program a few times. We need to do an update. You know, if maybe Sean can track them down. They had a website for a long time. You could, you know, Google Fox RGBH lawsuit. And so finally, they reached the point where the station was saying, no, you've got to rewrite it to the point where you're saying there's nothing wrong with this, everything's fine, don't worry. And they were like, we refuse to do that. You know, let us go report on some other story. You know, let us, you know, put us on the police beat. But we're not going to go on the air and lie. And they got fired. They're just fired. So they sued this Fox TV station in Florida for inappropriate dismissal, whatever the term is. And a jury of their peers, a jury of six Floridians, found in their favor. So Fox took this to an appeals court before a judge rather than a jury and said, we have the right to force our employees to lie when they're reporting the news because we have the right as a corporation. We have the First Amendment right of free speech, and free speech includes lying. You can say to your wife, yes, you don't look fat in that dress. And Fox won. And that precedent has stood right to this day. So you ask, can the news media be charged with sedition? You know, you can't even charge them with lying. So I think it would be a real stretch to charge him with sedition. But it's nice that the president went out today and offered a counter-narrative to the whole Bundy thing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. And Rob Cunningham is on the line with us. He's a conservative activist, filmmaker, USAF vet. RobCunninghamUSA.com is his website. And he is an activist specifically around the issue of Common Core. Common Core is the set of math and here's how it's described by the AFT. In June 10th, the Common Core State Standards Initiative, led by the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers, released the Common Core State Standards, CCSS, for math and English language arts and literacy in history, social studies, science, and technology. They were adopted by 45 states, the District of Columbia, four territories, and the Department of Defense. And they call for a shift away from excessive testing and a shift away from test preparation and a joint effort to develop highly focused, high-quality, coherent curriculum and systems. So, Rob Cunningham. Hey, Rob, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
So, I was all knee-jerk ready to go after Common Core. I remember back in 2001 or 2002, I forget what year it was, I had a conversation with Jim Jeffords in his office, the senator from Vermont at the time. I was living in Vermont. I was writing a book that ultimately became called Unequal Protection. And he left the Republican Party over No Child Left Behind because he asked the Congressional Research Service, the one that answers to Congress rather than to We the People, they do studies just for individual members of Congress, and they did a study for him on what would be the impact of No Child Left Behind. And the study basically, and their office shared parts of that with me to the extent that they legally could. I couldn't reprint it. But basically what it said was the outcome of this is that the $100 million a year testing industry is going to become a multi-billion dollar a year testing industry. And of course, this was in the early years of the Bush administration, and George Bush's brother Neil was, had just started cranking up a big educational testing business. And so Neil Bush would become very, very rich as a result of this. And that so offended Jim Jeffords that he left the Republican Party. I was assuming the Common Core was the same thing. And then I had a conversation with Randi Weingarten a couple of weeks ago with the American Federation of Teachers, I believe she's the president of. And she was like, no, this is not about testing at all. It's a completely different thing. What's your objection to this?
Well, first of all, let me just put on the record. My mama was a school teacher for 31 years. My wife, her mother's been a school teacher for almost 60 years. She's 78 years old and still substitute teaches in Jacksonville, Florida. So my concerns here are more the one-size-fits-all approach to education, regardless of location, regardless of status, regardless of whether you're a gifted child or whether you're a special needs with an individual educational development plan. A one-size-fits-all approach to education is absolutely destructive to the art of teaching.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I mean, these are, though, just basic minimum standards for normal curriculum. There are obviously exceptions in here for programs for gifted kids. There are obviously exceptions in here for kids who are who have IEPs, who are struggling or who have learning disabilities. That's not what Common Core is all about. I thought one of the cool things about Common Core, and I remember Jim Jeffords told me that, I was like, why are Republicans supporting this? And he was like, because we're getting a lot of money from, and you know, why has this become a conservative issue, and how did Teddy Kennedy get bamboozled with this thing? And he said, you know, Republicans are supporting this because we're getting a lot of money from the private testing industry. There are billions of dollars. It used to be millions. Now there are billions of dollars in profits to be made from No Child Left Behind. And what I like about Common Core is that it's open source. In other words, we can go back to the what I had when I was going to school, and when I was a kid in elementary school in the 1950s, was the teachers would take the tests and they would run them off on the Mimeo machine and pass them out. Because they were, you know, they were copyright free, or they were in the public domain, or the copyright was given to the teachers. And with Common Core, there's no copyright. There's no money to be made. And so I can understand where, you know, the companies that were funding the Republican Party so heavily during No Child Left Behind might be opposed to Common Core. But I don't get why somebody like yourself who has a concern about education would be opposed to it.
Well, Tom, I'm going to ask you to dig a little deeper because there's massive amounts of testing. And I'll tell you right now, the educators and progressives against Common Core are completely against the testing that is off the charts. The marketing, the messaging, and the folks that are behind this, that are proponents of Common Core, may be telling you that this is not about testing. I can tell you right now, the teachers are outraged at the level of testing, the teacher assessments. The teacher assessments are linked to the student testing performance and everything.
No, I'm sorry, you're wrong. I've got this article here that you sent us called Told Kids Must Take Standardized Tests Whether They Agree or Not from politichicks.tv about Karen Piper. Right. This, what she's referencing is OCGA, Oregon Law 20-2-282, the State Board of Education Rule 160-4-2.11. This is from the 2003 school year, first of all. And secondly, it was mandated by the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the ESEA, which is part of No Child Left Behind.
Correct.
So this has not – Common Core eliminates this.
Tom, Common Core was written – in sworn secrecy, in a collaborative group, and was funded and launched by the stimulus package. It was written in collaboration, but again, sworn secrecy. All four subject matters, English language arts, social studies, science, and math, were written. They were gradually rolled out. Those that disagreed, some of the most brilliant educators in America, if they disagree with the stimulus,
so tell me something that you disagree with here, Rob. You're opposed to Common Core.
High school math has the absolute single highest correlation to success post high school.
Right.
No matter what.
So what in the Common Core standards specifically?
High school math stops at Algebra 2. They are not STEM ready curriculum and standards to get kids in a global economy that's growing.
So you object to what, the lack of calculus or trig?
It's Algebra 2. Algebra 2 is the standard. It stops.
Algebra 2 can be fairly damn complex.
It sets us 2 years behind where we are today. Tom, it drops us back. It makes us less competitive. We're being told that this is a rigorous set of standards, and it's not. It's bringing us back. It's taking classical education and putting it in a meat grinder.
How many kids who are graduating from high school in the United States right now, nationwide, do you think could actually pass an Algebra 2 test?
Tom, I'll go you one better. Remember the New England Primer that we started with back in the early 1800s? I would bet you 20% of high school graduates today could not pass the New England Primer.
Oh, of course they couldn't. But let's not compare now with then. I mean,
Well, why wouldn't we want to have our students to have a comprehensive working knowledge that is based on creative?
So your objection to Common Core, then, is that it's not difficult enough.
No, Tom. Look, you and I are probably going to agree on a couple of things. Number one, the corporate cronyism involved. There is no reason that Bill and Melinda Gates have spent over $3 billion that we can count on the development of Common Core standards. There is no reason in the world that Bill.
They're not in the educational testing business.
They're in the end bloom.
In fact, this is open source stuff. It's free of copyright.
Look at the data collection related to Common Core, the standard of Common Core, and look at the industries that are surrounded by it.
So there's still an opportunity for somebody to make a buck.
Tons of money. Pearson Education, Pearson PLC are the two largest companies in the world, and they're involved in printing the textbooks.
Okay, I got it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
RobCunninghamUSA.com is the website. And thank you, Rob, for being opposed to big companies making money off our kids. I appreciate it. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Common Core, it's interesting. The conservative opposition to Common Core, conservatives are in favor of for-profit charter schools. They're in favor of for-profit testing companies. But now they're opposed to the possibility that with Common Core coming in that somebody might be able to make a living or make a buck. Compiling statistics? I'm not sure exactly how. But anyway, I Rama knows about this. After the next break, I want to get to him and get on this. But this is... It's Common Core stuff. This is one of those areas where I suspect there is very little knowledge outside of the teaching industry about what this really is all about. And that's one of those areas where, generally speaking, I will trust the professionals. Teachers were objecting to No Child Left Behind. And have been almost since the day it was introduced. The idea, the original idea, everybody was like, yeah, it's a great idea. But by the time the legislation got cranked out and it turned out that it was basically just industry friendly, Neil Bush industry. I mean, remember when Katrina happened and New Orleans was drowning and there were all these people that were being exported out of New Orleans and sent off to other communities around the United States, poor people who had literally lost not just their home, but their entire neighborhoods, and never to go back. And there was a large expat community of poor African Americans from the Ninth Ward, I think it was called, in New Orleans, who were in either Dallas or Houston. And Barbara Bush decided to make a donation. My recollection is it was $35,000. I might be wrong on that. But she wanted to very publicly make a donation to the Help New Orleans Katrina Fund. And she made the donation on the stipulation that it be given to her son's testing company to provide tests for, No Child Left Behind tests for kids from New Orleans who had made their way to Houston or Dallas, if my recollection of the news story is correct. I mean, this is how weird and incestuous the whole business can get. And it's why we really need to, on the one hand, having a common set of core standards for the nation of saying, if you graduate from high school, this is really what you should know, whether you grew up in coal country in West Virginia or on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, or in Beverly Hills, or in rural Oklahoma. This is what you should know. These are the standards. That's a good thing. So that there's some consistency and some understanding, at least with regard to a small number of topics. But let's dial back the whole testing thing. This is where Common Core, I think, was a big deal, is that it was all about dialing back the testing. There's no more mandatory testing, and there's no more copyrighted material. That seems like a good thing to me. Anyhow, we've got some people who want to weigh in on this. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, I'm getting messages from all quarters here. Common Core is funded by the Koch brothers. Alec likes it. Bill Gates likes it. It must be terrible. I don't know. When we were brainstorming this morning, I had suggested to Louise, we should follow Rob Cunningham with Randy Weingarten, who you know, the president of the teachers union who knows this stuff. Because I don't. And maybe we can get Randy on tomorrow to talk about it. I really think she should be on right now. But Rama in Williamstown, Vermont. Rama, you're a fairly common sense guy. You are the you must be. You were the very first producer of this program. You helped us start this show back 10 years ago.
I was smart enough to hook my wagon to your tail.
Well, thank
you,
sir.
Listen, and I'm
vice
also
versa.
Speaking. I'm also speaking from experiences being on a school board now for going into my sixth year, and
okay.
As we implement this too. So. While I'm not, you know, in-depth knowledgeable, I certainly have more than the average knowledge on it.
Good. Inform me.
So I think the first thing that happens is a confusion between topics, and this really explains why you and your guests would never be able to come to agreement. You were talking about the Common Core state standards, and you were absolutely correct. He was talking about the implementation of the Common Core state standards, and he was also, in general, quite correct. Because the Common Core state standards says nothing about evaluations or assessments.
Right.
It just, as you said, it provides a set of standards. And actually, speaking as a very progressive and a very libertarian when it comes to education, I think the Common Core state standards, if you get down and just read the standards and forget about all the distractions, is really great. And it provides a good basis for a good, solid curriculum. And the curriculum that comes out of that provides the basis for some really good in-house classes to be given.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the implementation of the Common Core state standards has in general, I'd say almost universally, gone along with just another set of widely used standardized testing. And generally, the two you'll hear the most connected with the Common Core, one is the acronyms are SBAC, which is SBAC, the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, and the other is PARC. And you'll have to forgive me, as I can only remember one of these acronyms, the one that applies to us in Vermont, mm-hmm. which is SBAC, but PARC is another acronym for having to do with the Assessment Consortium.
Mm-hmm.
And these can get expensive, even though you're correct technically that this is all open source. The exams themselves are not open source. They're very high security exams because, you know, they don't want to release them out into the public. And schools are having to go through a great deal of expense on buying new computers and upgrading in-house technology, et cetera, because the test is designed for both PARC and SBAC to be given by computer.
Right.
So there is, and plus, it depending on where you go, New York.
But
State
the test.
Actually,
but the, hang on just a second. Let me just clarify here.
Yeah.
These two testing consortiums, which presumably have large chunks of for-profit testing companies in them, associated with them, driving them, running them, whatever. Do I have that right? First of all.
You know what? On that one, I'm gonna
you don't
plead
know.
Ignorance.
Okay,
yeah.
All right, that's fine. So
yeah,
I'll plead ignorance too.
They're expensive for the schools to implement, though.
Right. Okay. So
we're having to invest an awful lot in technological improvements and upgrades and purchasing new computers and equipment in our schools.
But all that said, it's probably cheaper than developing your own set of tests to determine whether you're hitting the Common Core standards, right?
If the insistence is that you take that you want a common assessment to compare across states, which is generally why the states are going with this, they were
right.
hoping to do a national level assessment,
right.
but you know, one that's common across the nation, but that didn't work out. It would be cheaper, but you know, and I'm not saying, look, there's some value to these standardized tests. But they'll also be done with some in-house assessments, you know, that you're going to find from place to place.
Right.
But in general, if it's implemented right, the Common Core state standards, given a decent curriculum, which is turned into good classes in the school buildings, has an awful lot of promise. Its biggest
right.
promise is instead of trying to give out a mile wide and an inch deep worth of knowledge, you're going to go for a much narrower set of knowledge, but you're going to get into it much deeper so you understand concepts.
Right, at least with these core areas of literacy and math.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
so,
science, too. But
so, yeah, so Rama, you know all about hard breaks. We're about 30 seconds from one. So might it be accurate to say that this is sort of like healthcare? If we could just get the damn profit motive out of it, it would be a good thing?
Well, I don't know if I would say that. I would say be very leery of the of how they implement it.
But that's where the profit motive comes in. Somebody comes in and says to the school, "We'll sell you computers and we'll sell you tests."
Tom, you could be absolutely correct on that, and to some degree, I think you already are.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see how this all shakes out. But in net, you're on the school board. You guys are adopting it enthusiastically?
In general, yeah. In Vermont and certainly other areas in the Northeast that I'm familiar with, I mean, there are some problems. Like if you look across the state and across the border into New York, they're having issues, but that's mostly because they're using it as high-stakes assessments on the teachers, too.
Which is not how it was designed. But you can use it however you want. You know, it's a blunt instrument, as it were. Rama in Williamstown, Vermont. Thank you, Rama.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, step by step, I'm learning more and more. You are too. We'll continue this journey after this break. The very, very new Sivorously Ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, EcoWine.com. The good, Jimmy Carter. In an open letter put out yesterday, the former president joined 9 other Nobel laureates in urging the Obama administration to reject the Keystone XL pipeline. The letter reminds President Obama that while the climate crisis will require increasingly ambitious efforts to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius, the rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline has the potential to empower a generation that needs affirmation that their leaders are listening and care about their future. A rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline would signal a new course for the world's largest economy. This leadership by example would usher in a new era where climate change and pollution is given the urgent attention and focus it deserves. End of quote. Well said. It is further proof that America would be far better place today if Carter had beaten Reagan in the 1980 election. The bad, Greg Brophy, the Colorado State Senator and 2014 Republican candidate for governor, has found an edge over his competitors by giving away a rifle for free. Supporters got to register for the sweepstakes by logging on to Brophy's website and sending in their name, email address, zip code, and phone number. Lucky winner, a local police officer, got a Smith & Wesson M&P-15 rifle. The winner did have to pass a background check, but that doesn't mean Brophy's gun giveaway was a great idea. Lawmakers should be thinking of ways to make guns safer, not ways to make more people own guns. And the very, very ugly, Dan Clevenger, the mayor of Marionville, Missouri, is under fire today for telling a local TV station that he kind of agrees with Fraser Glenn Miller, the suspect in the deadly shooting at a Jewish community center in Kansas over the weekend. Here's a clip of Mayor Clevenger's remarks.
Clevenger says Miller's biased beliefs stayed strong.
I kind of agreed with him on some things, but I don't like to express that too much.
That hasn't always been the case. Nearly a decade ago, Clevenger wrote this letter to the editor, calling Fraser a friend and wanting to spread Miller's warnings. He spoke of the Jew-run medical industry that, quote, made a few Jews rich by killing us off. He also mentions the Jew-run government. 10 years later, Clevenger's views haven't seemed to change.
There's some things going on in this country that's destroying us. We got a false economy, and it's some of those corporations are run by Jews.
Clevenger now says that he's done talking about his views on Jews and Fraser Miller, which is probably a good thing because everything he's already said about the subject is very, very ugly. That's mind-boggling. That's mind-boggling that in this day and age, President, at his press conference, there's a nice summary of, you know, what was said, you know, minute by minute over at Daily Kos. And he says, if Republicans want to spend the entire next 6 months or year talking about repealing a health care bill, providing insurance to millions of people without providing any sort of alternative, that's their prerogative. It's wrong. It should stop. Oh, he's talking about the states that are denying Medicaid expansion. He says that's wrong. It should stop. Those 5 million folks should be able to get insurance like everyone else. Well said. So, Judy, in Festerville, Trevose, Pennsylvania, it says here you want to disagree with me about Common Core. I'm not sure I yet have a position on it other than that I like that it's open source and that I do think that there should be some set of standards, but go for it.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine, Judy.
Okay. I taught for 31 years, and I've been on Diane Ravitch's blog, and she used to work for the Bush administration. She's an education historian, and she was all in with Bush's educational thing until she realized how bad it was.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's actively blogging and getting articles from people all over the country, teachers, parents, educators, about all aspects of, you know, education and the confusion that's going on today between privatization. And so anyway, the Common Core is a set of standards that was written not by an educator, not by a child development person. I don't know, some guy in a university, and I wish I knew who it was. And I've seen a little bit of them, and I thought that what I saw was outrageous for first grade was something we had learned in junior high school. So, but I agree with that other guy. It takes the art out of teaching. And at first I agreed that there should be common standards, but I've taught in all kinds of different schools, and these kids are not starting in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
So you understand, you ran a school about, you understand about reading readiness, and if
sure.
you're not ready to read, you know, doesn't matter how, it's going to take 2, 3, 4 times as long to teach somebody how to read than
right.
somebody who is ready.
No, and I'm totally opposed to using any kind of testing standards at all to hold individual teachers or school districts accountable
well,
in a way that looks competitive with others. Because,
exactly.
You know,
and this is what's happening. Apparently, Arne Duncan, even though the federal government...
Oh, don't get me started on Arne Duncan.
Yeah, Arne Duncan is not, the federal government is not supposed to interfere with the state's educational thing. But the government, he's saying, with his race to the top, threatening school systems that we're not going to give you money unless you adopt the Common Core, unless they're tied to teacher performance.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really bad. So my suggestion to you, and if you would consider it, is to look up Diane Ravitch, and instead of having... who's the woman you're going to talk to?
Yeah, Randy Weingarten.
Randy Weingarten. Who is fine, but Diane Ravitch. This is what she does every day.
Yeah.
Talk to her. Have her call you up. I think.
Yeah, I see. I've seen her all over the place. She's become kind of a one woman industry on educational
she's
stuff.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And the amount of information I get every day from her, it's a yeoman's task, but she started a movement.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. I think you're right that, you know, we have to have some kinds of standards. But, you know, do Arne Duncan's kids or President Obama's kids or anybody else's kids who are rich have to take all of these tests? Some schools are giving 15 tests a year to kindergartners.
No, this is crazy.
Really?
This is crazy. Well, that's why, you know, what pleased me about Common Core standards was that there were no testing requirements in there at all.
But there are. They're tied to the tests. The tests were written by Pearson, who was also involved in the charter school industry. It's a whole industry.
Yeah.
So, and if the Common Core standards, if you don't get a certain percentage of your school meeting the Common Core standards, you not only don't get money, your teachers get fired, but then people can say, public schools stink.
Yeah.
And for the most part, according to Diane Ravitch, outside of the cities where, you know, people are having a really hard time, you know, making it and their kids are having a difficult time. And I've taught those kids and they really so many problems. Outside of that, our kids are doing fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Judy, I will take your advice. I'll look for Diane. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul. Welcome.
Hey,
thanks for listening to KBCS.
Yeah. I've taught math and science for a number of years, and as far as I know, the SAT still only really requires, I mean, it's set up so that you only need to have Algebra 1 year, and 1 year of geometry. If you have 100% mastery over those two things, you should do fine on the math section.
Of the SAT, which is what is used by colleges to determine your eligibility or whatever the appropriate word is.
Admittance eligibility, yeah. And the problem is that most people, the kids especially, don't get enough practice to be good problem solvers in 1 year of working that kind of math. So you go into Algebra 2. Algebra 2 has, well, first of all, Algebra 1 does have some trigonometry in it, basic, you know, the basic trig functions, what they are and what they mean. And Algebra 2 has a lot more trig problems in it. But there aren't any complicated trig problems on the SAT. The thing is, I always advocate that if we had better command of lower-level skills, and in particular arithmetic, if all the problems get started really in arithmetic in elementary school, and the problem is that elementary teachers they're not math teachers. They are assigned to have to teach arithmetic, and arithmetic you can mostly do in your head. It's sort of tangible and concrete, but the actual math principles are not adequately taught. So when they make the transition to using variables, they're like, oh, what?
And another reason why this is so important is because the principles of math are the principles of logic.
Right. Well, exactly. You know, I used to have kids ask me about geometry. Why do I have to learn this? And I would tell them, because whenever somebody realizes that they can exploit your logic, that you have logical flaws in your thinking, they will do so and separate you from your money.
Right. Right. And if you understand, you know, basic math, basic algebra and basic geometry, you understand basic logic, the flow of information in logic and in debate. And I remember taking debate and our debate teacher when I was in high school was using basically algebraic equations to define our debate principles. And I thought that was so cool. You know, it's like that's when it kind of all clicked for me. Paul, thanks a lot for the call, and I hope to see you when I get out there to Seattle on, what is it, May 1st or May 2nd? I think it's May 1st. I'll be out there. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back. Interesting. People want to talk about Common Core. They want to talk about the chemical soup that we're all in. We talked about in the first hour. We'll be back with more. And welcome back. Alan in Chandler. Click the button there. Alan in Chandler, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today? You wanted to talk about this congressman who went off on the minimum wage guy?
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment on the minimum wage. I saw the interaction between that government official and that young man who worked at the fast food situation, and I think he was 12 years old.
No, the congressman said he had his first job when he was 12, yeah.
Right, first job he was 12. My comment is there's a difference between signing a W-2 form for Burger King and taking your lawnmower out and mowing lawns. And so I was really set back by what I saw. I'm 50 years old now, a college graduate and a decorated war veteran, two combat tours. So, and I've been fired or forced out of every job I've had since I've been out of the military. So I understand where that one young man was coming from, but it was hard for me to wrap my head around why that congressman would speak to that individual that way. And that was my comment. And I want to thank you for speaking for cats like me.
You're welcome. I think that the congressman was speaking to that young man the way he was because he had no idea, A, what it means to be poor, to be the working poor in America. And B, he has no idea what it means to be a minority in America. And this is what I said earlier. The thing that struck me and the conversation that I think that we should be having in this country that we never seem to have, we just never get around to, is what is white privilege? And it's not just, increasingly now, it's not just white privilege. I mean, you know, last night on my TV show, I had a debate with a conservative who was African American. And he was saying the Civil Rights Act might be unconstitutional, for example. I mean, you know, taking all these very conservative positions. And increasingly, it's not just white privilege, it's class privilege. Because we have people of color who are, you know, who have moved into the middle class, the upper middle class, and the upper classes, and you know, I mean, you can't say that. Well, I was going to get into some sort of Clarence Thomas rant there, but I'm not going to go there. In any case, the point is that I don't, you know, that congressman, I guarantee you, was not born with the structural disadvantages that that young man had, or that any person, frankly, of any race has, whose only job option is to work at Arby's in their 20s or their 30s. And it's obviously not just Arby's, because it's like this is now the state right across America. It used to be that if you could get a job, in other words, you became part of the working class before Reagan, you could become part of the middle class because jobs paid well. The biggest employer in America was General Motors. They set the salary floor, and it was $50 an hour in today's money. Today, if you can get a job, that means you have entry into the level of the working poor, not the middle class. The working class and the middle class from the 1930s to the 1970s or 80s were the same thing, by and large. And now they've separated. So, anyway, we'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harbin with you. And Randy in Buffalo, New York, you wanted to talk about Common Core. Thanks for listening to iHeartRadio. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. First-time caller, long-time listener, big fan here. I want to agree, or I concur with a previous caller about Diane Ravitch.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote a book, came out in the fall, called The Reign of Error. And in that book, she gets into the history of Common Core and how they are absolutely tied into standardized testing and teacher evaluations. I'm a teacher in New York State, and 40% of our annual evaluation is based on the results of our students' testing. And that has kind of created a crisis here in New York State in public schools in the sense that before the Common Core was introduced, and last year was officially the first year it was rolled out in New York State, and implementation has been an utter disaster. Before Common Core, we did have an annual standardized test that were based on which I thought were very good, solid educational standards here in New York State. And the woman I think before explained how, because of Race to the Top, states were forced by the National Education Department, the Department of Education, to adapt these new standards in order to receive Race to the Top funding. So that is absolutely true. Before Common Core, I spent an average of maybe 1 week, quote-unquote, teaching to the test. Since Common Core, and I am not exaggerating or using hyperbole, you have teachers who are spending months teaching to the test. Because 40% of your annual evaluation is based on the results of a test, which has, last year, the first year that the new standardized tests were based on the Common Core standards. Over 60% of all public school students in New York State across the board failed these tests.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it would really be beneficial to get Ms. Ravitch on your program.
Yeah, no, it's on my list already, Ray. That's
so
a done deal.
This is what's going on in New York State. Mm-hmm. I have never.
What do you offer? You're a teacher. What would if somebody made you president? Or head of the Department of Education, or God, or whatever, and you could wave a wand and change everything. What would you do? How would you do it?
What would I do, Tom?
In fact, let me back up. Even before I ask you what you do, what are the biggest problems that educators face?
I think what we're facing now, number one, is morale. There has been a war on public education for a long time to make people think that public education in the United States is terrible, that when we stack up, when you stack us up against other nations, when you look at international test scores, we don't do that well. Well, however, when you factor out poverty, when you look at districts that have less than 40% poverty rate, and you look at those scores across the board, we generally do very, very well. So there is this, in the media, it happens in the media, it's...
Well, plus teachers, because they're unionized, have been the favorite whipping boys of the Republicans for years.
Yes, to crush the unions, the teacher union.
Yeah.
So your question, what would I do?
Right.
I would try to do something which tackles childhood poverty and poverty in the United States. Because the one thing that Common Core and the new educational reform doesn't address is that student performance is not, there's this idea that teachers matter the most. Well, of course teachers matter, but what really matters the most is the home life from which a student comes. And that is the area that...
Right, and we're not talking about the old Republican slogan of, you know, is there a dad in the home or does dad work and mom stay home? It's not about that. It's about, is this family struggling to survive or not? And
Absolutely. This,
so really, our education department should be a subset of our of HUD, really, housing and urban uh-huh. development. Or, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that's a really great idea. I think you're really spot on about that. So, just in a nutshell, there are huge problems with Common Core. The way they were developed, for instance, there's in New York State, there's no way to amend them. I personally, I'm pretty familiar with the standards that apply to third to sixth grade. Mm-hmm. Some of the standards are okay. Many of them are developmentally not appropriate. Absolutely not. But there's no process in New York State to look. Let's look at them. Let's get developmental psychologists involved. Those people were not involved in the creation of these things. You have fourth graders reading a novel like something that 2 years ago was assigned to sixth and seventh grade. You've got fourth grade readers. You know,
right.
Talk Everlasting, for instance. Do you want 8 and 9 year olds to be discussing the afterlife? And you know, it's just and David Coleman is one of the people who developed the standards in English language arts and reading. And the approach that they recommend classroom teachers to use from reading is against everything we've learned professionally in how to teach reading. So there are some huge, huge problems with
that. So we're not back to the phonics debate, are we?
No. Phonics, you know, has its value sometimes in the classroom. No, they're not.
Except you can't teach phonics using phonics. You can't spell phonics using phonics.
Right. Yeah. No.
I always thought that was so ironic.
The method of reading that Mr. Coleman would like teachers to use in New York State is called close reading, C-L-O-S-E. And I'll briefly give you an example. Let's say you have a fifth grade classroom.
We have a half a minute.
Kids. You present them with the Gettysburg Address. You are to read that as a classroom experience with no discussion of background knowledge whatsoever. Kids are to extract meaning just from what the words say. So they don't exactly. This is what I'm talking about. I'm sure there are going to be people calling or going to call up after me and discuss in more depth about what this close reading thing is. But to make a Common Core.
Context is everything. I mean, particularly with the Gettysburg Address.
Exactly. Diane Ravitch, I think in one of her most recent blogs, DianeRavitch.net, she gives an example about the Gettysburg Address.
Yeah, it sounds like a good one. Ray, thank you for your service to our children and for your call. And thanks for listening to the show. I appreciate it. We'll be back coming up on the top of the hour. We'll continue with our conversation here. Actually, we've got a few other things as well.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Okay, my rant for the day. We have the Koch brothers. They're now worth $100 billion. A few years ago, it was $80 billion. A few years before that, it was $50 billion. It's now $100 billion. How is there value in that? This is like the end of the Monopoly game, where one guy has got all the money and all the properties, and everybody's paying rent. I'm suggesting if you can't live on $999,999,999.99, there's something wrong with you. Peter Schiff is the CEO and Chief Global Strategist for Euro Pacific Capital, host of the Peter Schiff Show on radio, and author of the latest, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F, radio.com is his website. Peter, welcome back to the program. It's been a while.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Yeah.
Why should we tolerate billionaires in the United States? All this extra money is not in the productive economy.
Well, of course it is. But when you say you don't want to tolerate it, I mean, what is your plan? I mean, you said that $1 billion should be enough money. And I don't know where you're coming up with that figure. Why a billion? Why not 2 billion? Why not half a billion? But what is your solution? Are you suggesting that we should steal, confiscate any wealth that anybody accumulates in excess of that number? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. I'm with Thomas Jefferson on this. He said that He certainly did. He said, not literally money. That. You know, I could find the quote for you if you'd like, but I can paraphrase it. He said that if wealth grows to the point where it threatens a free state, and you can easily Google this, that the appropriate response is taxation that is geometric taxation.
So I'm saying basically
100% tax on all wealth over $1 billion.
So basically, what you're saying is, let's say an individual entrepreneur creates a company,
right,
and that company achieves $1 billion valuation.
Right.
You want that guy to retire, cash out, stop working, not grow the business, not produce even more innovative products, not hire any more people, but just when you hit $1 billion, you just stop working, you retire, and, you know, there's no more growth. You don't innovate. You don't invent. You know, when Steve Jobs came up with, I don't even know when he got his first billion, but you know, whatever inventions he made after that shouldn't exist.
Do you remember what Steve Jobs' paycheck was when he took back over Apple?
But you're talking about net worth, though. You said no.
$1.
No, but that's because he was a shareholder in the company. I mean, a lot of billionaires don't have big paychecks, right?
Okay.
I mean, Warren Buffett.
Point taken. Here's my take on what would happen. If you look back at what happened when Teddy Roosevelt initiated the breakup of Standard Oil. And ultimately it was not Republican Roosevelt, it was Republican Taft who finished the job, broke it into 28 companies. Shareholder value was dramatically increased. Competition was increased. The price of fuel went down. We saw tremendous innovation in the marketplace.
But the price of fuel was going down. Hold on. The price of kerosene was going down every year that Rockefeller was controlling Standard Oil. In fact, the main
objection, his cartels were
No, no. The main objection to Standard Oil was that he kept lowering prices and the competitors couldn't compete. But
you're misrepresenting it. Go back and read the history. It was that he was colluding with the railroad companies to refuse to carry the kerosene of his competitors.
No. But I want to talk about modern day.
Talk about the modern day. If I had had an opportunity to finish the sentence, that's what I was going to do. Is I was going to say when Richard Nixon decided to break up AT&T and it finally ended up during the Carter administration, again, what we saw was an explosion in innovation. We saw, the stockholder value. If you held AT&T shares before the breakup, you ended up making a lot of money as a result of that breakup. Good thing for all of us.
None of that is at your point. I want you to explain to me, a guy has a business.
Right.
He becomes a billionaire, and now you want him to stop working. You say, we don't want you to hire any more people.
Let me ask you, put it as a rhetorical question. I'll give you a very specific answer. We can use the Koch brothers, but let me give you a flip side rhetorical question. When the top marginal tax rate was 91% and the CEOs of all the big companies in America stopped, and that 91% didn't kick in until after you made about $3 million in today's dollars. There was basically not a single CEO in America who was making more than $3 million in today's dollars. And from the 1950s until the 1980s, you did not have the emergence of billionaires in the United States, even people who were innovative in starting companies.
No. In taxable compensation, when during that brief period in our history where income tax rates were that high, because for most of
40
our history,
years.
For most of our in history, we had no income tax. OK, but during that period where the rates were that high, there were so many exemptions in the tax code that nobody really paid that rate. They paid it on a small fraction of their income.
CEO compensation was 30-1 to working people. There's a reason why, and it was because of that high tax rate. As soon as that tax rate went away, as soon as Reagan dropped that from 74 down to 28%, you saw CEOs start to make 100-1, then 200-1. Now it's like 1,000-1.
I can tell you that. Look, I would trade the tax code when the top income tax rate was 90%. I would take that tax code today over what we have now because I would pay a lot less taxes under that tax code because I would be able to arrange my affairs in such a way that I would barely pay any taxes. And it's
here's how
thing.
I would deal with Steve Jobs and Apple, okay? Since you asked. Or I could use the Koch brothers as an example. You just have to let me finish a sentence or two to give you the actual answer. You'd say to Steve Jobs, we're going to cap your wealth at $1 billion. So, you've got a bunch of stock in Apple, and that stock is now worth more than $1 billion. You need to start selling that stock off unless you want to start paying taxes on it. Well, actually, you will,
But you can't. You have to give it away because if he sells it, he gets cash and you want to take that away from him.
Fine. Start giving that stock to your employees the same way the CEO of GM was paying. GM's average pay in the 1960s and 70s was $50 an hour. Start passing that back to your employees, and you will end up a minority stockholder in a majority company.
But that's not how it's
going to work. You don't want to let me finish my thought.
Well, you want to enslave these people and say once you got $1 billion, you have to work for the benefit of somebody else. You can't have anything of what you
earn.
Peter,
my heart is not going
to
bleed for some guy who's worth $999 million.
They're not going to work for free.
And the fact of the matter is that Steve Jobs would still be Apple when it becomes a public company, although it always was, and Steve Jobs was not, he didn't own more than 50% of the stock. But let's, use Koch Industries as an example. If you were to say to the Koch brothers, Koch Industries is a privately held company. They own all the stock or the vast majority of it. Now you have to distribute that stock. It becomes a publicly held company. And if the public, if all the stockholders still think that these people running it is a good idea, then they will hire them to run it. But
if
your wealth is over $1 billion, that's where you stop.
They're worth $100 billion right now.
Right.
What you're saying is when they were worth $2 billion, they should have retired. They should have fired.
No, I'm not saying they should have retired. I'm saying they should have stopped accumulating wealth.
But that means retiring. What do you think they're working for? They're not going to work for nothing. They're not going to be our slaves.
There's a lot of people who work for the pleasure
Why
of work.
Why should they? Why do you want to enslave other people
because
and expect they're going to work for the benefit of you?
I've worked for free many times in my life. I love my work.
Well, how about, you know, you want to confiscate the wealth of everybody that has over a billion. I don't know what your net worth is, but assumably there are people that have less money than you. Maybe they think you have too much. Maybe they want to confiscate what you have.
Could build a case that my wealth has reached the point that Thomas Jefferson talked about where it threatens a free state,
no,
then I would agree with you.
Look, this wealth in private hands,
$100 billion in the hands
that
of two people threatens
the
a free state.
What
these guys are proving
free
it.
Free state is big government. You want to make government bigger? That's what threatens
no,
freedom.
No, the Koch brothers want to own a big government. They want to put their shills in political office so that they own a big government.
No, the Koch brothers want to dismantle government. Government is too big. The Koch brothers
Republicans have never dismantled government, Peter. You and I have to agree on that. You know that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Peter Schiff, P-E-T-E-R-S-C... Oh, I'm sorry, Schiff Radio, S-C-H-I-F-F Radio.com. Peter, thank you for dropping by.
Sure.
Good talking to you. Good to be back. It actually is a very interesting question. You know, what do we do with this problem that we have, which is we've got a bunch of billionaires? What are you going to do with the Walton family? You know, they're not even working anymore, and they're accumulating billions of dollars. You say, hey, you can keep $1 billion of it. The rest of it goes to society, and we're gonna use that to build a 21st century country. We're going to get off fossil fuels in 2 years. We got some serious problems in this country. We're going to do away with poverty. So wait a minute. You're talking like some kind of Nazi? You want to storm in and take people's money? Well, no, only the billionaires. We're talking about a few hundred people. And if you can't live on $999,999.99 in your checking account, then you've got a bigger problem than I ever could have understood. Anyhow, Larry in Nutley, New Jersey, listening on WBAI. Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Switch from speaker. Here I am.
Thank you.
Hello?
Yeah.
Something that's been puzzling me of the coverage of this Bundy incident.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't anyone pointing out that the federal government releasing the cattle is essentially violating the stated policy of the U.S. government not to negotiate with terrorists or give in to terrorist demands?
It's a good question. I think that the Obama administration, I mean, if you go back and you look at the photos of Tim McVeigh sitting on the hood of a truck watching Waco burn, and then 2 years later to the day blowing up the federal building in Oklahoma City, and you listen to what Mr. Bundy said, where he asked a county law officer, county sheriff, to disarm federal officers of the law. The common thread here between Bundy's belief that county sheriffs have sovereignty over the federal government, Tim McVeigh's belief that county officials have sovereignty over the federal government, David Koresh's belief that county officials have sovereignty over the federal government, and the militia movement and even some folks in the Tea Party's belief that county government should have sovereignty over the federal government, county officials. What you're looking at, I mean, since 9/11, 21 people in America have died at the hands of Islamic terrorists. 34 people have died at the hands of right-wing militia people. And I think the Obama administration is looking at this going, these people are more deadly than the Islamic fundamentalists among us. And they are well embedded, and they are capable of doing tremendous damage. We're just going to back off, let this thing cool down. I mean, you had Sean Hannity out there, you know, basically begging this guy he was going to kill a federal official.
That begs the whole question.
And then just wipe out the guy's checking account. Garnish everything.
You don't negotiate with terrorists. You don't give in to their demands precisely because it strengthens them. It encourages others to take that action.
In principle, Larry, I absolutely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. But can you imagine how it would have played out if somebody in the Bundy family had gotten shot? I mean, the right would have their, it would be like Randy Weaver with Ruby Ridge. They would have a martyr. And Obama denied them a martyr. I think that at a certain level, that's a good thing. But you're absolutely right. These you know, you shouldn't negotiate with terrorists, especially the you know the guys who are with the rifles up on top of the road. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States. Is Walmart a person? No. I mean, you know, maybe in the dreams of, you know, I heard an interesting comment last night on one of the shows I was watching. I forget which one. I think it was one of the MSNBC shows. But the guy said, if millionaires, forget billionaires, if millionaires, multimillionaires were a class, if multimillionaires were a class, they represent less than 3% of the U.S. population. I was astounded it was that high. But actually, you know, there's a lot of people who own, you know, they worked all their lives to buy a house, and the house is, you know, and they bought the house for $45,000-$50,000 back 25 years ago in the San Fernando Valley or in San Francisco or something, and now the house is worth $700,000. And you add that to whatever they've got, you know, after 40 years in a 401k, and they're actually, their net worth adds up to over $1 million. They're not rich people. They're just, you know. So let's say it is 3% of the American population. They represent more than 50% of the House of Representatives, more than 90% of the Senate. The White House, the guy in the White House is a millionaire. It's like virtually every person who has run for president of the United States in the last decade or so has been a millionaire. It's like we've got government by millionaires. It's pretty amazing. So anyway, in our first hour, we were talking about this uncontrolled experiment that we're all part of with all these chemicals in our food supply, and what is it doing to us, and what is happening? You know, I mean, we're seeing explosions of type 2 diabetes, explosions of cancer, particularly childhood cancer, explosions of autism, explosions in a whole variety of areas that I think, you know, 50 years ago we never would have predicted. And I was, you know, I told the story of my father being exposed to asbestos when he had to drop out of college and go to work in a steel mill when mom got pregnant with me back in 1950-51. And that asbestos exposure killed him. Back in 2006, he died of mesothelioma. And which is an asbestos-caused cancer. And back in the 50s, the steel mill knew, or at least the asbestos industry knew. They'd known since the 1930s that asbestos caused mesothelioma. But they were still willing to make a buck off it. The lead industry knew that lead in paint and gasoline caused neurological damage, but they were willing to make a buck off it. And now we've got hundreds of thousands of chemicals, or tens of thousands of chemicals being dumped into our environment. We don't have the precautionary principle in the United States. So anyhow, I went off on that in the first hour. In our second hour, we were talking about Common Core. What is it? How does it work? We're going to get into that in more detail as in future shows. What I learned is how much I don't know about this. It's very interesting talking to Rama, who's on a school board in Vermont. We had a couple of teachers call in, some fascinating stuff. And then, of course, in our third hour, my contention, we have a website, nobillionaires.com, that enough already, right? Enough. $1 billion should be enough to live on. John in Tujunga, California. Hey, John, maybe we should just make it, if you're liquid, $1 billion. That's but I don't know how you define this. Anyhow, John, thanks for listening to KPFK. What's up?
Hi. When you were talking to that guy who was pushing his idea through on you, I didn't hear the full Thomas Jefferson blurb about wealth distribution.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up.
But you know, I've had difficult times thinking about the efficiency increase to society by not having these guys have so much compared to everyone else. And
you would see society become more efficient as a consequence of that.
Yeah. My question to you is it because it would prevent them by taking away the disparity? would it prevent them from being able to sell the rest of us out?
No, it's what it is, is that when wealth gets truly massive, like, you know, what we're talking about here, $100 billion, that wealth either A, represents basically monopoly ownership. It's, you know, such great ownership of an industry or of areas that it's competition goes out the window. You no longer have a competitive marketplace. You know, it's no longer free enterprise and capitalism, number one. Or number two, wealth starts getting stashed overseas, offshore. Basically it gets taken out of the productive marketplace. And my argument is an anti-monopoly argument at its core, which is when we broke up AT&T, when we broke up Standard Oil, it actually created wealth. It created competition. It was a good thing for our country. And that, you know, a wealth tax. Now, the conservative argument, and there was one made back in 2012 in the Wall Street Journal. The fellow wrote an op-ed, Dennis McKinnon, if I'm remembering his name correctly, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal suggesting that after $10 million, there should be either 1.5 or 3% tax on all wealth over $10 million. That would be enough that we could, that would generate enough revenue that we could start dialing back on the income tax. And that's true, but I say, you know, why make it a small tax on $10 million? Why not make it a large tax on $1 billion? I mean, you know, it's because I'm frankly concerned about the impact of great wealth on democracy. When you have people who have enough money to own politicians and own entire states, then I think that you've got a serious problem. John, thanks for the call. During the break, I'll track down the Jefferson quote. I'll share it with you. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Check out The Middle Class Is Not Normal is an op-ed that I wrote 2 days ago over at truthout.org. It has a lot of Jefferson stuff in it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's not the last page here. I'm looking for my Jefferson quotes here. Paragraph 5 of Scrooge. Ah, okay. Here we go. Thomas Jefferson laid this out in an 1816 letter to Samuel Kercheval. Oh, yeah. He said, those seeking profits were they given total freedom would not be the ones to trust to keep government pure and our rights secure. Indeed, it has always been those seeking wealth who were the source of corruption in government. No other depositories of power have ever yet been found which did not end in converting to their own profit the earnings of those committed to their charge. Okay. Indeed, it has always been those seeking wealth who were the source of corruption in government. He went on to say, I am not among those who fear the people. Now think about Alec and all her efforts to stop voting all across the Republican Party. You know, I am not among those who fear the people. They, and not the rich, are our dependents for continued freedom. We must make our election between economy and liberty, or profusion and servitude. Otherwise, as the people of England are, and keep in mind, this was, you know, during this was a little pre-Victorian, but basically in England you had no middle class. You had the rich, very small rich class. You had a very small middle class, which was the doctors and lawyers and bankers and shop owners. The mercantilists and the professionalists. And then you had a very large class of working people who were the working poor. So Jefferson says, otherwise, as the people of England are, our people like them must come to labor 16 hours in the 24, and the 16th being insufficient to afford us bread, we must live as they do now on oatmeal and potatoes, have no time to think, no means of calling the mismanagers to account. Now, are we talking about today? Right? If you could reduce people to poverty, they can't even get into the streets to call, you know, to no means to calling the mismanagers to account, but be glad to obtain subsistence. Now get this, just think about this for a minute, about the people who are so, you know, pleased that they got a job as a manager at Walmart or something. But be glad to obtain subsistence by hiring themselves to rivet their chains on the necks of our fellow sufferers. He said a totally free market would transform the country, quote, until the bulk of the society is reduced to be mere automatons of misery and to have no sensibilities left but for sinning and suffering. Then indeed begins the bella omnium in omnia. This is a phrase. This is a verbatim. He lifted that out of Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes. The bella omnia et omnia, the war of all against all. It's Latin. Then begins indeed the bellum omnium it in omnia, which some observers, he's talking about Hobbes, observing to be so general in this world, have mistaken for the natural instead of the abusive state of man. Which gets back to my old riff about, you know, the whole conservative worldview is based on Hobbes's worldview, that Hobbes's assumption that the natural state of man is that you've got rulers and the ruled, that you've got predators and prey. And Jefferson was saying, no, that's not the natural state of man. Or mankind. Or humankind. I mean, you know, to use the language of his time. So I think that we need to be seriously looking at what Teddy Roosevelt was saying. Here's in 1785, this is a letter to James Madison from Thomas Jefferson. Another means of silently lessening the inequality of property is to exempt all from taxation below a certain point and to tax the higher portions of property in geometrical progression as they rise. In 1784, taxes should be proportioned to what may be annually spared by the individual. And as noted earlier, as wealth rises, so should taxes geometrically. In an 1826 letter to William B. Giles, Jefferson warned back then, right. 1826. He was an old man then. This was a year or two before he died. He said, some conservatives, my phrase, he was talking actually about the John Adams wing, the Federalists. He said, they now look to a single and splendid government of an aristocracy founded on banking institutions and moneyed in corporations under the guise and cloak of their favorite branches of manufactures, commerce, and navigation. See, the modern day equivalent of that would be are the oil barons, right? The coal barons, the defense industry. They now look to a single and splendid government of an aristocracy founded on banking institutions and moneyed in corporations under the guise and cloak of their favored branches of manufactures, commerce, and navigation, riding and ruling over the plundered plowman and beggared yeomanry. The plowman, the farmer, the yeomanry, the yeoman is the worker. This will be to them a next best blessing to the monarchy of their first aim and perhaps the surest stepping stone to it. Thomas Jefferson, who died bankrupt, had some understanding of, you know, what was going on with these guys. And then this is my favorite of his quotes. This is April 6, 1816, his letter to Joseph Milligan. If the overgrown wealth of an individual, say, Daddy Coke, who founded or helped found the John Birch Society and bequeathed millions to his sons. If the overgrown wealth of an individual be deemed dangerous to the state, the best corrective is the law of equal inheritance to all in equal degree. An inheritance tax. Now, he was also, at that point, he was, in fact, one of the first pieces of legislation he proposed, maybe 30 years earlier, 35, 40 years earlier, when he was in the House of Burgesses in Virginia, was to do away with the, I'm forgetting the old archaic name for it, but they had a law that said that the oldest male inherited everything. And he was the oldest son of his father. And when his father died, he inherited his mother and his brother and sisters, basically inherited responsibility for them. And he was like, you know, a teenager. And he fought against that law. Primogeniture. Yeah, it's called primogeniture. And he was a big opponent of the law of primogeniture. And he did not succeed in overturning that in his lifetime, but he was pretty emphatic about it. So anyhow, I think Thomas Jefferson would be with me on this. Back to your calls. Bob in Philadelphia, you wanted to get back to education?
Oh, yeah, I was listening to that debate about the public school funding, and I'm all for public schools, of course, but...
But?
In the debate, they don't usually bring in discussion about, like, hours of TV watching versus the success in school.
And there is some correlation, but the thing that is the biggest correlation between the predictive outcome of a child in school and any other variable. You know, there's a lot of things that move the needle just a little bit, like how much they watch TV, whether or not they exercise, whether or not they're overweight, you know, what kind of diet they have. I mean, there's a bunch of little things that you can find small correlations with, and whenever anybody does, it becomes some big news story, right? You know, we need to go back to the Kennedy, you know, health programs JFK had where everybody was out there exercising, all that kind of stuff. But the one thing that moves the needle hugely is poverty. So if you want to solve the problem of our schools in America, solve our poverty problem. Lift 40 million children out of poverty. Maybe it's as many as 50 million children out of poverty in the United States. And our school problem will be solved overnight. And we could do that if we simply put 100% wealth tax on our billionaires. What do you think?
I don't disagree.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bob. Great to hear from you. Thomas in Port Angeles, Washington, listening on KKBI, our Pacific affiliate. Hey, Thomas, what's up?
Yeah, I think it's KABI.
KABI. Yeah.
But it's out of Bellingham. One of the common threads in this parallel stream of propaganda we've got going on between the far left and the left and the far right and the right, right, is that there's things that are left out that you have to look out for. That's one of the reasons I listen to radio a lot, is because I'm trying to identify these things that get presented in a way that's not comprehensive.
Yeah. Okay. Thomas, hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Thomas, my bad. I never hold people over a break, but I put you on with 20 seconds to go. I totally missed my time cue. It was my mistake. And so please finish your thought.
No, not to worry, Tom. The how things get presented on cable television, how things get presented on ABC, NBC, the repetitiveness of it all, particularly on all the bad news you can get. What I told your screener was one example of this is saying that Warren Buffett or Bill Gates is worth, you know, $100 billion.
Right.
All right. And, you know, you touch on it from time to time, and it's an assessed value, mm-hmm. right? Now, you would think that if you present it in the context of that's an assessed value of everything that guy and his team have gone out and built, that's part of that value. All the people that work in that structure that they created that are earning a wage, right, mm-hmm. is part of that value, right? The product that goes out and gets sold, right?
Well, no, it's indirectly because what they own is stock. And if you were to say to Bill Gates tomorrow, you can have $1 billion, but the rest of it, we're either going to take or you have to give away, he would give it away. And I think that, you know, the way that he would give it away, you know, and this is probably true of every other billionaire in America, you know, that by giving it away, they would be empowering. I mean, who knows? I mean, some right wingers would be giving it away to right wing think tanks. Left wingers would be giving it, but it would be, you know, it would turn everybody into Andrew Carnegie. Andrew Carnegie gave away not all of his money, but a large chunk of his money in the last years of his life because he did not want to die rich.
In the last years of his life.
Yeah, because he didn't want it to go to his heirs.
And there was a movement in that direction. Not but about 4 or 5 years ago where Bill Gates and I think Warren Buffett came on board or I'm not sure which way the inducement flowed.
It started with Warren Buffett. Give away half your wealth.
But they did give up a great deal of their wealth, but there was some paybacks in that in tax incentives and stuff.
Well, it turned out actually that when Gates endowed the Gates Foundation, he made a net profit on the money he gave away because that's how bizarre our tax law has, you know, how much Swiss cheese our tax law is, but the intent was to give it away.
Yeah, that's one of the things I can take to my Tea Party forum and say, look, if we're not listening to, right, the people that we've been brainwashed to think are our opposition, we're going to miss a lot of gemstones along the way.
Yeah.
Right. And it's really hard for the comprehensive Tea Party type folks to walk that tightrope and not get sucked into, you know, in some cases on both sides of that fence, an absolutely bizarre, non-comprehensive, it's recognizable as a propaganda stream, right?
Right.
And I'm just not happy with my propaganda stream. Right? Either one of them. And I spend my time bouncing off the walls, taking a look for things to get left out.
Yeah. Right? Well, if you identify things that are being left out of my particular propaganda stream, please call me and fill them in. Because I think my goal here is not to advance a particular candidate or party but rather simply to share a worldview that's mine uniquely. And I'm willing to be convinced when I'm wrong. Thank you, Thomas, for the call. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Larry in Antioch, Tennessee. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Fine. Thank you. What's up?
Good. Glad to hear it. Just a couple of very, very quick things, sir. First of all, I wanted to say, since I have never called before, I'm a fairly recent viewer of your show and your network. And I have enjoyed it so very, very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV.
I had no idea anything like this was on television. And one day, I don't know if I was channel surfing or what, but there you were. And anyway, it was love at first sight.
Thank you.
So, honestly, I did have a couple of quick points. One is I agree with virtually everything you say, not the 100% tax on billionaires, and I'll explain that briefly if you want me to, because that's not a workable idea. But I do wonder, excuse me, Tom, I'm so sorry. I do wonder, since you are so incredibly political and so incredibly intelligent and so on and so on, have you ever considered running for the Senate or the Congress or for president for that matter?
No. I'm a good author and I think I'm a good talk show host. The ratings seem to bear that out.
So I
think that there, you know, some, you know, wise advice my father gave me years ago, do what you're good at and don't try to do what you're not good at. I would make a lousy politician, Larry. Do you ever see Bulworth?
I don't think so.
Do you ever see the movie Bulworth?
Huh?
Did you ever see the movie Bullworth?
Bullworth?
Yeah, it's a movie that what's the guy's name? Warren Beatty is in it, and he's a politician, and all of a sudden he just starts telling the truth, and everything blows up all around him, that would be me.
It would not happen to you.
Yeah, it would be a disaster. It would be a disaster.
It would not happen to you. Look, Tom, here's the way it goes. Okay, just listen to me for a second. Look, you would, first of all, Congress, whether it's, just, I don't know if the Senate needs you the worst or the House of Representatives. Okay, it's hard to say. You would be an asset to either one, and you would certainly be an asset as President of the United States.
Here's the other thing, Larry, and I want to actually have this as a serious conversation because people who are listening who might be thinking of running for political office need to be considering these things. The one thing that I've learned from hanging around with politicians for the years that I've been doing political talk radio and from covering politicians as a reporter back when I was a teenager in my early 20s in Lansing, Michigan. And part of my beat was every week I had to interview Jerry Graves, the mayor. I had a bunch of members of the Michigan House of Representatives and the Senate that I was, and the governor. And it was a big thrill, you know, being 18 years old, sticking a microphone in these guys' faces. But the one thing, I'm going to give you an example. I was doing a fundraiser for Jim, I want to say McGovern. That's not his last name. The congressman from Washington State. He was being sued. He's still a congressman from Washington State. He's a psychiatrist, and he's got a Scottish last name. And he was sued by Newt Gingrich because he released that audio tape that caught Newt Gingrich committing a federal felony on a cell phone call. And Newt Gingrich had to resign from Congress as a result of that. Gingrich sued him for $350,000. And Bill Clinton and I did a fundraiser for this guy up in Seattle. And Jim McDermott is his name. Thank you, Shane. And in fact, I got a picture of me and Jim McDermott and Bill Clinton. So Bill Clinton and I show up to do a fundraiser for Jim McDermott. And I'm standing backstage with Bill Clinton. It's the first time I'd ever met him. And it's just, and Jim McDermott is out on the stage, and then I'm going to go out and say a few words, and then I introduce Bill Clinton. And while McDermott is out on stage talking, and there's like 3,000 people out in the audience, and I'm back in the wings, and there's two Secret Service guys about 10 feet away from me, and they've already frisked me. They know I'm not going to, I don't have a knife or a gun or anything, but they're keeping an eye on me. And I'm standing here with Bill Clinton. It's just the two of us. And he just turns his entire presence on me. And he's like, well, tell me about yourself, son. And I said a few words. He's like, oh, that's fascinating. And he remembered it all. The feeling that I got was that I was the most important person in the world to him. And I have some good friends, Ellen Ratner here at the Talk Radio News and others, who have known Clinton for years and years and years. And they will tell you stories about how he would meet somebody at a county fair or something and see them again 5 years later and call them out by name. Hey, Bill, great to see you again. How's Sally? I can't remember the names of the people I work with. There is, and it is literally true. There is a type of intelligence. Howard Gardner wrote this book called The Seven Intelligences back in the day. And one of the seven intelligences that he identified is called interpersonal intelligence, the ability to just absolutely interact with other people in a way that makes them, just bang. I don't have that. I am autistic in that regard. I'm incompetent in that regard. And that's the characteristic that I've seen in every good politician. Go ahead. Yeah.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
Okay, you're selling yourself short in that respect.
No, this is where I'd be a lousy politician.
Listen to me for once.
Okay.
Please listen to me.
You got the last minute of the show.
Bill Clinton. Oh, look. Bill Clinton has a photographic memory. You don't have to have a photographic memory to have a good political career, period. Now, the reason that a billionaire, 100% tax on billionaires, will not work is because the billionaire will definitely stop working after the first billion. I was an in-law to a gentleman by the name of Sam Zell, who you had on the show recently.
Yeah, but if the billionaire stops working, that means that somebody else can take his job. Isn't that a good thing?
But the billionaire doesn't have that job. A billionaire is an entrepreneur. The billionaire will simply go to another country and continue what he's doing somewhere else.
Fine. Good riddance. It'll open up opportunities for entrepreneurs in America. This is an entrepreneurial country. That's what happened when we broke up AT&T. We broke up the billionaire. We broke up that giant monopoly. And what happened? What came out of that? MCI, WorldCom, Verizon. I mean, all these companies came out of breaking up AT&T. Larry, thank you for the call. I, you know, and forgive me for taking seriously your comment about politics, but I really do think that if there are people who are watching who have that human intelligence that I was talking about, that Bill Clinton ability, please jump into politics. But it ain't me. I'm no good at it. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. That means brunch with Bernie, another guy who actually has that kind of intelligence, Bernie Sanders. And don't forget, democracy begins with you tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.